Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey friends, welcome to another edition of the Tennis and Bagels podcast. And today joining me is a Hall of Famer, absolute legend, historian. We've had him on the podcast several times, usually recapping majors. But this time I'm proud to have him on after recapping what was a wonderful Indian Wells with super, super great matches all across the board overall on both the men's and women's side and some great energy around the grounds, which I hadn't been seen in years. And I was fortunate enough to go for a couple of days. It was an awesome experience. But Steve, how are you today?
Good to be with you, Vaj. Yeah, it was a really spectacular tournament, both the men's and women's divisions. Maybe the best Indian Wells in a very, very long time.
Yep, totally agree with that. And I guess we should start by talking a little bit about the women's side in general and kind of the landscape of the WTA as a whole, because obviously Elena Rybakina won this tournament, defeating the world number one and number two back to back in doing so. And, there's been a lot of talk in the tennis world lately about, there being potentially a new cohort of three players sort of sharing the dominance on the tour a little bit more. Last year was kind of like Iga was the head and shoulders above the rest of the field, but now it really feels like since the US Open, especially, that there are three or four players, particularly Iga Swiatek, Aryna Sabalenka, Elena Rybakina, and I would even throw in Barbora Krejcikova in there as well, contending for these trophies, specifically on a hard court. Do you see it that way?
I do. I'm not sure about Krejcikova being quite up there with the other three, but the case can be made. I can easily see why you would believe that, and I'd like to see that happen. I think the ability is there. I want to see the consistency in her results and see her stay healthy, and maybe she may well make it quite a foursome, but the other three have just been magnificent. I mean, especially thinking about what Rybakina has done, starting with Wimbledon. And obviously, many of us were a little disappointed that Ons Jabeur didn't beat her in the final. It seemed like it was going to be the moment for Ons, and she loses a really hard-fought match there at Wimbledon. Now Rybakina goes on and reaches the final. The Australian played quite well against Sabalenka, and then here she beats Swiatek, and she beats Sabalenka back-to-back, as you said. So those three tournaments are just such clear-cut proof of where she is in the women's game right now. And it's fascinating to me, Vaj, to see Sabalenka. We saw that got jittery after serve again and served those 10 doubles in the first set. So what can you say? That was a little bit of an old problem coming back to haunt her again. I think she'll move past it again. She got tight in this case, but Swiatek, I don't know. There's certain types of players at certain times that can overwhelm her, overpower her on a given day, and that's what happened with Rybakina here. I'm really interested to see, because we all thought, I'm sure you did too, that Australia was one thing with the quicker courts for Rybakina to beat Iga. But then to repeat it here, when everybody was talking, and obviously Medvedev complaining a storm up about how slow those hard courts were, and they clearly are. They didn't look very slow, even in the evening air, when Rybakina beat Swiatek. I mean, she made it look like a quick court. She was so effective with her style, with her quick striking styles. I just think there's a lot to look forward to with this trio. Some great matchups and potentially some compelling rivalries.
Yeah, certainly the Sabalenka-Rybakina, the two matches that we've seen so far this year, they've been very compelling for many different reasons. And, 13-11 first set tiebreak. And, Sabalenka with, unfortunately, 10 double faults. It was kind of a little bit reminiscent because, I mean, obviously she hit 7 before the tiebreak even started and then 3 in the tiebreak itself. And, it kind of affected a little bit the way she started the second set. just hangover. And
Arturo
set to lose, you know, with 80 minutes, and whoever was going to lose that set was just, it was going to be brutal.
No, I think that's a deliberate understatement on your part, because those first two games of the second set, you could see that Sabalenka was shell-shocked and distraught and almost ready to break into tears at one point. She's a very emotional woman, and I like that in her. But you could see that she was so disappointed, because obviously one of those three doubles in the tiebreak that you just talked about was on set point. Yeah. It's the last thing you want to do on a set point, make the other girl play. I mean, she would have been better off to throw in a second serve first just to make sure she didn't have that anxiety attack. So, but those first two games of the second set were really what cost Sabalenka the match. Mm-hmm. She eventually went down two breaks, got one of them back. It wasn't good enough. But I just think that it's understandable in some ways, because Rybakina puts everybody under so much pressure. And she hits the ball so deep herself. She manages to avoid long rallies for the most part. And she finds her openings and goes to them. And then she has, one of the two or three best first serves in the women's game. So it's a tough combination to beat.
Yeah, totally. And, Rybakina's first serve percentage wasn't super high in this match. And even then, she had to hit so many second serves, and she really held her own, I thought, in that department. And, regarding the service issues, I wonder if it was Rybakina's aggressive returns and also the wind. I wonder how much of that really played havoc as well.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. The wind was difficult the whole tournament for everybody, but no doubt it compounded the problems of Sabalenka. And then, yes, she could feel that she knew that Rybakina was going to take those returns early, the second serve returns, and really, really hit them with authority. And that weighs on your mind as well. And, actually in this case, it was a little bit of a reversal from Australia. In this case, she returned better than Sabalenka.
Yeah.
There was some role reversals here, and partly it was the conditions. It was. And she had played quite well, and it wasn't super windy when she played Swiatek, but it was windy enough. So she handled the wind well the whole tournament, I thought, and then peaked in the final. It was a really terrific conclusion for the women those last couple of rounds, even though we didn't get necessarily the tightest matches. We got the best players, and we got very high-quality tennis on both sides of the net.
Yeah, for sure. I'm interested to get your thoughts a little bit more on Swiatek, just because, she seemed to have rebounded nicely after the Australian Open, obviously picking up a title. But many of those victories were, they were very one-sided in terms of, she wasn't facing a lot of resistance from her opposition. And then, as soon as she came up against Krejcikova in the Dubai final, or, here against Rybakina, she wasn't really able to offer much resistance. And of course, she cited the rib injury being a factor, and I'm sure it definitely was. But, I didn't particularly see anything, during the match itself that would indicate she was struggling with anything physical. I think it was largely mental. And as soon as she went down an early break and lost that first set, it was 5-love within a flash in the second set. And it seemed to just get away from her, and she didn't really have a plan B.
I agree with you. Frankly, I don't think that Iga should have brought up the injury. I think it comes off, but she doesn't mean it that way. I'm not saying it's intentional. Comes off as an alibi. Comes off as sour grapes. I agree with you. There wasn't much evidence of it. It just looked to me like she just got thoroughly outplayed and beaten to the punch quickly and early in these rallies, that she didn't play the match on her terms. I wish she would have given a bit more credit to her opponent, but it has to be worrisome for her that there are a few players out there like Krejcikova, like Rybakina, that can take it out of her hands a bit. I don't mean totally take the racket out of her hands, but they can rush her out of these matches. And in this case, it would happen on the slowest of hard courts. That has to be a concern. I obviously think she thought she was going to get revenge. I don't mean in a personal, bitter way. But she did, the pride is there, and she surely thought it surely was frustrating as she looked back, because she probably believed going into the Australian Open that it would be her tournament. And that didn't happen. And here was the chance to sort of set the record straight and prove that she's the best in the world. And now there's some doubts again, as there were between after she won the French Open last year up until the U.S. Open was a bit shaken. And the U.S. Open was a very important win for her to take a second slam title in the season. But again, at the end of the year, she took it on the chin a few times, too. We saw that. And so she's not, despite that big 37-match winning streak a year ago, she's not dominating the sport. I don't know if she's ever going to have that kind of a grip on it again. She will be right in the thick of things. And there's certain types of players in certain tournaments where she will come through confidently. But boy, there are certain matches, certain matchups that present that are really problematic for her right now.
Yeah. I agree with that, and you know, it'll be interesting to see how she does in Miami, and you know, potential quarterfinal with Rybakina as well. So it'll be interesting to see if we get that rematch and if the result.
I hope we do because to see her play her again that soon would be fascinating. Because especially if she's in the tournament, I mean, if this injury is serious, then maybe she doesn't even make the quarterfinals. We'll see what happens. But I if she's in the quarters and looking good up until the quarters, I can't imagine that rib injury is that serious, and therefore that the immediate rematch would be really a great to see.
For sure, yeah. A couple of other players I wanted to know were in the latter rounds that I wanted to get your take on. One of which is Maria Sakkari. Obviously, we know we know what a great player she is. You know, been in the top 8, top 10 for 3 years in a row now. You know, been to the finals of Indian Wells last year, Guadalajara as well. A little disappointing in the slams. And you know, I thought it was a good mental effort on her part to get to the semis here, particularly the match against Kvitova, where she was in danger of going down double break in that second set, and also all of her other matches throughout the whole tournament, always coming back from a breakdown in the third or
right. You
know, a set down, you know, several times. Shelby Rogers had her up a set and a break, so matches like that do impress me. But then it feels like every single time she gets to the latter rounds, you know, semis and particularly in the semifinal stage, where it just, you know, she comes up and she kind of hits that ceiling. And, you know, we saw it again against Sabalenka. It was a great performance by her, but, you know, it's got to be weighing on her now quite a bit, I think, mentally. And also, I just think tactically, you know, she has a very flat backhand. And I just think, you know, sometimes I wish she developed her slice a little bit more. So I feel like that could be effective for her in defense. Just give her a little bit more options, you know, something else for the opponent to, when you think about it, and when she's constructing her points, because obviously she's one of the most physical players around, and you know, Sabalenka really out-physicaled her in that match.
Oh, thoroughly. No, I agree about the slice backhand. I'd also like to see some serious work put into her serve. She's got a good serve. She really needs more free points off that serve, because if that were the case, you wouldn't see three setters every round and having to go down to the wire every round like she did here, and that takes its toll. And then that could be part of the reason. If it had only been the Kvitova match, maybe she's fresher for that semifinal. But yeah, I'm concerned about it because it seems to catch up to her in the latter stages of so many tournaments. And I just wonder if it would be different if we, you know, if she could serve a little bit, the serve became more of a weapon and she started winning matches, more matches, 3-3, 3-4, you know, efficient at matches that don't tax her too much and leave her with more energy for the latter rounds. But yes, it isn't just one type of player that's beating her either. I mean, she's so much fun to watch, and she's got a lot of charisma out there, and she's got her followers with good reason. But yeah, this has been a pattern, and it doesn't seem to be changing right now. So something has to change, I think, in her game. And I would say, agree with you on the slice back, and that's an easy change to make. The serve, more difficult but doable, and I hope she really goes to work on that. Obviously, she doesn't have the height of some of the other players. She's not as tall, but that doesn't mean she can't serve bigger. She definitely can.
Yeah, and I've seen her serve big when she's down in the score, and she has to get a few free points and, you know, get back into it. And I just wish she'd start matches off like that, and, you know, maybe that would just relieve a lot of the pressure that she's under in these tight situations, because I just think she gets so tense and so nervous, and you can just kind of see it in her face. It's, you know, it becomes really obvious for the
opponent. Yeah, it does. But she just can't allow herself to think, though, when I'm down, I'll throw in a big serve and then it's good enough. It's got to be consistently there. She wants to be able to win 2-3 free points a game if possible, and then put all the physical work into breaking serve. save all the running for that. But if you can get through some service games in a minute and a half, which some players can do with 3-4 swings of the racket, that can make a real difference.
Yeah, for sure. And of course, the other quarterfinalist was Coco Gauff, who is still, extremely young, 19 years of age, done quite a bit already. He's winning a lot of the matches she's supposed to win. But, just like Sakkari, gets into these quarterfinal rounds, and I guess fourth rounds and majors, and occasionally a couple of semifinals, and runs into a top 10 player, and then tends to lose pretty comprehensively, and most of the time it's the forehand that really just lets her down in these big moments. And I wonder if Coco and her team really have to go back to the drawing board and figure out, do some, go back in the garage, kind of like how Sabalenka did during the offseason this year, and see what needs to be done technically, because the backswing seems too big, the grip is obviously very extreme, and we commentators point out these things all the time, but also I wonder if it's even a risk worth taking, because she's so well established right now in the top 10 that she'd inevitably have to take a step or two back in order to make these technical improvements, and that could affect her results in the short to medium term. But I wonder if it's something long term, because it's going to be tough to win a slam even on clay with that forehand.
Yeah, no. At this level, you can't get away with it. And the coaches and commentators have been talking about this, really, even since before she got to the French Open final a year ago. Yeah. Maybe going back a couple of years. Trouble is, when you make a major final like that and you succeed on this level, it can be deceiving. You don't deliberately deceive yourself, but you're thinking, well, look how I'm doing it, and I don't know how she feels about it, her father, coaching staff. It seems like there's some ambivalence about it, but it's so clear that that's the weakness of her game. The other players know it. They gun for it. They break it down. Yeah, you might be right. I think you're probably right about the backswing, but it just needs a really keen coach's eye and, a period of a couple of weeks, maybe skip a full Hanovit tournament prior to. And somewhere along the line here, maybe overplay on the clay and take the time to restructure the stroke. It doesn't necessarily have to be a sweeping change, but they've got to do something so that it becomes a much more solid stroke. I mean, of all the players at or near the top, that's probably the most glaring weakness you could find in any of them. And therefore, the opposition just breaks it down time and again.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely something for her and her team to consider moving forward. Still a top 8 player, of course, but also it was a pretty good tournament. Go ahead.
No, she's not satisfied with top 8. We know that. It's a tough reputation to build. It's hard to live up to those high aspirations, but that's what she's after, and that's what she's capable of, and there's no reason not to sacrifice just a little bit much of the short term for the betterment of the long term. And I don't even mean just sort of wrecking her 2023 season. I just mean a little chunk of time, maybe at the beginning of this clay court circuit now, or if it's not going to be done then it's got to be done post-Wimbledon, because there won't be any other blocks. But you take the time and you do almost nothing but hit forehands and really hone in almost entirely on that shot, because we know she's got an awfully good two-hander, a very good burst serve. She's not double folding the way she did a while back. There are real strides in other areas. So if she can at least make the forehand less of a weakness, that's a start.
Yep, absolutely. What other takeaways from the women's side? I mean, there was a good tournament from Emma Raducanu, getting 2 top 20 wins and playing Swiatek tight for, about half a set or
right
in that.
Right.
And it was just good to see her, because, coming into the tournament, with concerns, so obviously she had tonsillitis, but also concerns over her wrist. I really wasn't expecting anything. And so for her to get to the fourth round was a pretty big, good result and a huge step in the right direction, I think.
Yeah, very good first set against Swiatek. You're right. It by after 3-2, it wasn't quite the same, but she gave her something to think about up until then, and I think impressed everyone with her level of play and her forehand. So I just feel like, Emma's on the right track. Let's see what she does in Miami.
Yeah.
But that was a good step.
Yeah, unfortunately, though, she is playing Bianca Andreescu in the first
No, I
round, and
understand.
that's.
I understand, but that's an opportunity for her as it is for Bianca, because
Yeah.
not too much pressure, actually not on either one of them, but especially on, Raducanu. There's just not a lot of that. That would be such a good win for her right now. Frankly, I think she's got a shot there. You never know with Andreescu. She played awfully well in Indian Wells, but I think that's a match that Raducanu's got a maybe a 40-45% chance to win.
Yeah, for sure. It'll be interesting to see because the winner of that will play Sakari as well, and yeah, plenty of good first round matches in Miami. But I guess let's shift gears and let's talk about Carlos Alcaraz. You know, wins the entire tournament without dropping a set. You know, youngest ever to win Indian Wells in Miami, and you know, you can reel off 5 or 10 other ridiculous stats. But really, what impressed me so much, Steve, about this tournament and obviously his whole, you know, last 1 month coming back from injury, making the two finals in South America, and then, you know, coming so close against Cam Nori even despite the injury, and you know, having very little time in preparation before Indian Wells to then play the tournament that he plays, and beating Medvedev in the final. Really, I thought I saw a much more patient version of Alcaraz, but he was still able to keep what makes him so great. You know, with the explosiveness and the speed and the combination of the touch and the power and just exhilarating brand of tennis, and he was able to just, you know, bottle it all at once for solid 10 days. And really, I mean, some of the worst tennis he played would have probably been for 3 or 4 games against Sinner in the first set, and he still managed to win that. So it's a really, really big achievement, I think. And you know, frankly, I think he's probably the favorite to do the Sunshine Double. I don't really see many things stopping him from winning Miami as well.
No, he's the favorite. I agree with that assessment. I wouldn't be too hard on him for the lapse against Sinner. He's up 4-2. It's true. You figure with 4-2, 2 holds, he's got the set. It was a very shaky 3 games when he won 1 point. But still, when he had to answer the call,
Yeah, and the tiebreak, it was
well,
phenomenal.
but he,
And the set point saved as well, the drop shot.
well, yeah, four, but first 4-5, 15-30, and then 5-6 set point down. So those were clutch holds
Oh,
for
yeah.
him just to get to the tiebreak, and then the way he closed out the breaker from 4 points all. Yeah, that was reminiscent of the best Carlos that we saw a year ago. This time last year, when he went on his best tear of the year, from the semis of Indian Wells to winning Miami to winning Madrid, that was really the best we saw from all season long, with possible exception to the U.S. Open, which were like gritty performances. But no, I agree with you. There was more consistency. I particularly liked. We can talk about the final in a minute because I was a little puzzled by Medvedev's performance.
Yeah.
But the FAA match, I thought Carlos was very disciplined, and his return of serve was excellent, and he was just way too good from the baseline for Felix, and only lost his serve once, and that was early in the second. And it was I loved the way he played that match. He really controlled the tempo and frustrated Felix. And it was windy, and he handled the wind much better. And then the Sinner match, yes, there was that difficult stretch, but he gets through the first set and plays a nearly flawless second set. So I feel like he gave himself all that confidence coming into the final, and that was tough luck on Sinner, because on the set point, Carlos hit a drop shot that was good, not his very best, and Sinner got there pretty well, pretty quickly, and had options to maybe go cross court or at least go low down the line. Well, he went up down the line far too high. It was easy for Carlos to just cut across and put the forehand volley into the open court. That was such a big point. But listen, I feel like, and then in the final, of course, Alcaraz never even faced a break point against Medvedev in the two sets. Won 81% of his first serve points. He was devastating on backing up his serve. It wasn't. There was some serving and volleying. He had, no doubt, Daniel off balance and confused, and Daniel didn't really know what was coming next. But in turn, we saw from Medvedev one of the most perplexing performances I've seen from him in a long time. I mean, this is a guy that Alcaraz called prior to the final a wall. He's a wall, and that's how we think of him. And to get through that wall, normally you're going to have to do what Novak does and be willing to rally with him for 36, 38 strokes. Many, many 24, 26, 28 stroke rallies, but it's going to be long, strenuous, hard work. And Daniel's going to keep the ball deep, and he's going to deliberately prolong the rallies, and he has that great margin for error off both sides. Despite being a flat ball hitter, he knows how to clear the net by a healthy margin and just not make mistakes. But here, in so many ways against Carlos, and it has partially to do with what you said about Carlos's improved patience himself. He was showing that he wasn't going to miss much, and he was still going to stay aggressive. But Medvedev, inexplicably, never seemed to try to prolong the rallies and turn it into that kind of a contest, which is more on his terms. Perhaps it was the wind. He said after the match he didn't know exactly what it was, whether it was Carlos's ball or whether it was the wind. Maybe it was a combination of the two, but he didn't play Medvedevian tennis, if I can put it that way. He didn't play the kind of, I will not miss a ball and I dare you to stay out with here with me all day long kind of tennis. He was actually quite impatient. And then even after Medvedev bunch climbed back in, he made the first set respectable after a very bad start. Carlos raced to a 3-love lead. Carlos was terrific in that first set, and that one break counted. But when Medvedev had a couple of three holes after going down 3-love, and the last two holes were very easy ones, and I thought, okay, let's see how he starts this second set to see if he can sort of get his teeth into this contest. He made three pretty bad errors in a row, followed by a feeble double fault in the net to give Alcaraz the immediate break for 1-love in the second set. I don't think he ever really recovered from that. It was a disappointing match from his side of that. I thought Alcaraz was inventive and smart, and the serving and volleying selectively was great, and the combination of power and consistency was all there. You know, taking the back and down the line when he needed to, he had it all working for him. But I didn't think he was pushed that much. As strange as he was, I mean, you would not have thought that was Medvedev on the other side of the net. Maybe it was that Daniel was going for his fourth title in a row, and he won 19 matches in a row, and he had all that mid-tournament bickering about the conditions being too slow, and this isn't like a hard court, and I'm a hard court specialist, and he escapes against Zverev, which was fortunate. But then I thought after that he got going, and when he came out of the Zverev match and beat Davidovich Fokina, and then comes through a nice semi with Tiafo, despite having all that difficulty, and Tiafo saving 7 match points in the second set, late in the second set, still thought it was a very good performance from Medvedev, who had the mental toughness to get to the tiebreak despite all the scare that he had going into it. And I just thought he was going to play a lot better. If he had, it might not have been good enough. Perhaps this Carlos was in great form. I'm not saying that I think that Medvedev would have necessarily won, but we should have seen a much tighter contest. Would you agree?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like, you know, I was going into the match expecting Carlos to win, but in a very close match, you know, I was expecting it to be tight and hard fought.
Yeah.
I was expecting Daniel to, you know, play his normal patient game, you know, and go for the offense at the right moments. And he just was struggling to create from the back of the court at all. And his serve was completely neutralized. He had 0 aces, you know, which hasn't happened to him in like since 2020. And it was,
well, 0 aces, and he doesn't even get to break point on Carlos' serve. Even on his own serve there, the way he would play this was, Carlos returned very well. I give him a lot of credit for getting so many deep returns back in the play. But Daniel just didn't seem willing to work the points.
Yeah.
And so he kind of played into Carlos's hands, and Carlos was more than happy to keep setting the agenda, dictating the tempo. And listen, he was going to be hard to beat under any circumstances, but I think the whole flavor of the match would have been very different if Carlos had been pressed more, and then we would have seen him face a little tension. That never really happened because, you know, he just totally outclassed Medvedev on this occasion. It'll be interesting. You know what I find interesting, Bunch, is that I can't wait to see these two play again, and certainly hard court, because on clay, I would give Alcaraz a clear edge. It's just not Medvedev's surface. At this point, we haven't seen, I don't see the evidence that he beats Carlos on clay, but I want to see them meet again on a hard court soon, or maybe even at Wimbledon, to see if Medvedev learned anything from this, if that put some definite doubts into his mind, because it's an important rivalry for both of them. Very important rivalry that conceivably they're going to play a lot of big matches in the next couple of years. And obviously Novak's going to be in there with them. And that those contests are awfully important. And I don't think Medvedev ever envisioned that he could lose this final 3-2 so routinely.
Yeah. Despite it being the worst court for him and still getting to the final.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be interesting to see if they play on a faster hard court, you know.
Yeah, but I think...
Even Miami, I think, will be interesting. Hopefully, you know, we can see them square off in the final there. And
yeah, that would be nice. But what I'm saying is, okay, it's still hard court, though. Maybe the worst hard court. By the time he beat Tiafoe, and it could well have been a 5-3 match rather than 5-6, because that's when he had the first three match point. I thought he was looking, I thought we saw some vintage Medvedev, especially up till 5-3 of the second set. Some of those forehand passing shots were just magnificent, and he wasn't missing at all. And the announcers were even, I remember Jim Courier on the air asking his fellow announcers, you know, can anybody beat Medvedev when he's playing like this? You know, he was that impressed at that point. And I just feel like, sure, he would have been proud of himself for winning on a court that he didn't really like. But he's in the finals at this point. So seemingly he's put all that behind him. He certainly likes clay less than he likes the slow, hard courts of Indian Wells, one would think. So it does make you a little concerned for how well he's going to do from Monte Carlo through Roland Garros. That's also going to be interesting to see if Medvedev can do better on the clay than usual.
Yeah, I'm interested to see that as well, because we haven't seen him play a full clay season since 2019.
True.
You know,
true.
He's had the hernia thing, and then before that he had COVID and 20.
Yeah, the hernia. That's right. The hernia was a big problem last year. I agree, but I'm saying that I don't know whether the extra tournaments are going to necessarily help. They could make matters worse if he needs to sort of get off to a decent start in Monte Carlo and try to be in a quarter or a semi there at least to build a little confidence. Because if he starts losing early right off the bat there, it could carry over to the. And I have no doubt in my mind, the way that he played through this stretch, that regardless of what happens on the clay, once we get back onto the grass and the hard courts through the summer and the U.S. Open, we'll see the best of Medvedev again. But in the short term, I'm a little concerned about how well he's going to fare on the clay, even if it is a full season.
Yeah. Do you find Medvedev to be pretty entertaining, you know, and particularly in the interviews after the matches and press conferences, and the way he's so like honest and revealing, and that side of him is very refreshing to see. And then you couple that with, you know, some of his quotes on court and things like that, and just like, you know, what an enigma sometimes in terms of personality.
Oh, completely, because he can. I mean, to be complaining to the umpire that this is not a hard court.
Yeah,
you know, hard court specialist. He can be very irrational on the court. Sometimes also venting too much with his team, which he has not been doing through this recent stretch during the winning streak and even through Indian Wells, not too much bickering with them. Mm-hmm. But no, as far as the off-court Medvedev, the post-match Medvedev, the interview room or the Tennis Channel interviews or whatever he's doing, he's extremely entertaining, and it is the candor. You said the honesty. He's candid. He really tells you what he thinks, which is why I was fascinated by his post-match comment after the Alcaraz match, where said he didn't know if it was Alcaraz's ball or if it was the wind, or he couldn't put his finger on what had gone wrong. But I believe that was honest too, and that they'll go back to the tapes and he and his coach will really try. They'll try to figure this out. They should they should get some more clues by looking at it on tape. But no, he's very likable off the court, not always on the court, and not when he's sort of snarling and surly, and that can happen. But when the match is over, you know, he's sporting. He was very nice in the presentation ceremony. And
yeah,
and the candor is very impressive. You say refreshing. I would agree with that, because most players are understandably a little more guarded. They don't want to give too much away. He just sort of tells you exactly what he thinks.
Yes.
He admitted how tight he got when he tried to close out Tiafoe, because the first three match points were at 5-3. Okay, that's on Francis' serve. But then he serves to the match and gets broken. And he serves to the match a second time at 6-5 and has 40 love and four more match points. And he admitted that he was nervous. He admitted that he was thinking, you know, this may not be very good for you, obviously conceding that dark thoughts were going through his mind, obviously, and he put them out of his mind. But I like the fact that he acknowledged that, because most players will not necessarily do that. So he can be very good for the game in that respect. And I hope that what will happen is if you maintain this demeanor, Raj, on the court too, of trying to be not reveal too much of his emotions and just get out of the match and don't play the martyr. Don't play the victim. Don't complain to your coach if you got an unlucky break at an inopportune time. And that's largely what he's done from the time he started the winning streak right after losing out for Brass in the final of Indian Wells. So there's some very good signs for Medvedev.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of other players this is a match I really enjoyed watching, which was Fritz against Sinner. In the quarterfinals, I enjoyed that match so much. The ball striking, the way these players were hitting the ball, 85, 90 miles per hour on both sides, in such devastating winds too. Like it was just amazing. And obviously, we know Sinner, he won all the longer rallies, like 27-9, I think was the final count there.
Yeah.
All those above nine shots, and then Fritz really did so well to win that second set, and he really upped his serving. And then they had a really tight third set, and it was a good title defense, I thought, overall for Fritz, even though he moves down from 5 to 10 in the world. And for Sinner, he's really showing that he's one of the best players this year, and his ranking is only going to go up. And I'm interested to see how many more, if he can start producing at this level and win some of the more bigger titles, obviously, because we know he's made the Masters 1000 final in Miami and starting to reverse a few more of those head-to-heads a little bit, got the win over Tsitsipas in Rotterdam and, picked up this other top five win over Fritz. So if you should see if that continues and what the next match against Alcaraz would look like.
Well, that'll be important too, because we hadn't seen them since the Open and that epic five-setter, 5 hours, 15 minutes, Alcaraz winning from match point down in the fourth set, wins it in five from a breakdown in the fifth. No, I mean, just to sort of cover your ground here, I thought it was very entertaining tennis against Fritz, and I agree. And Fritz is definitely proving that he belongs in the top 10, whether it should be 5, 7, or 10, we don't know. He'll probably bounce around in that territory. But I did feel, you alluded to the key stat, that the fact that he's losing 3/4 of the points that go 9 strokes or more, you could feel it all the way through. And it was going to be hard to avoid those. That's a lot of points going that many strokes. And Sinner, you just felt like he'd get in a rhythm. The longer the rally went, the better off he was going to be. So it didn't surprise me that he won in the end. What surprised me more was actually how Fritz managed to sort of grab the second set, getting a break at the very end of the set.
Yeah.
And, a little fluctuation at the beginning of the third, then he breaks back and they're all the way to 4-all, and finally he loses. So I thought he did very well to keep it that close, given that to me Sinner looked definitely looked like the better player. So listen, it was a good defense. He played well to get to the quarters, and I think Taylor would do okay on the clay, and he could do quite well at Wimbledon again when they get back on the grass. So he's going to be fine. And as far as Sinner's concerned, yeah, you pointed out, yeah, he's been in the final in Miami. It's time for him to sort of, this was tough luck. He was on the same half of the draw as Carlos, and he did the best he could. He's still in the semis. I think we'll see very good things from him on the clay, by the way. There's nothing wrong with him on clay whatsoever, even though you think of him as being better on hard because he's one of the biggest hitters on the tour. So I'm encouraged about him. I think this loss stung. He'll be upset that he didn't get the first set, which was going to be was more critical for him than it was for Carlos, in my view. Could have seen Carlos coming back from a set down. I didn't ever feel like Sinner would. Yeah. Not that he was hanging his head or negative, but just that Carlos is such a great front runner. I didn't see how Sinner was going to escape once that tight first set got away. But I do feel like he is a candidate to finish the year in the top five. I think if he's playing to his full ability, you know, by the end of the year, we'll have Djokovic, Alcaraz, Medvedev, Tsitsipas, and Sinner. That would be my top five if I had to call it now. And maybe Sinner ahead of Tsitsipas. But I expect him to be in that territory if he plays the way I believe he can.
Yeah. And another player in his age group, obviously Holger Rune. Been kind of an up and down start for him this year. Overall, obviously a couple of injuries and, you know, still had the cramping issue in Acapulco as well. And then this match against Stan. I mean, obviously you can trace it back to the row that they had in Paris where, you know, Stan had those two match points and he missed those returns. And then he told Holger at the net, my advice to you is to, you know, stop being a crybaby or, you know, something to that effect. And then after this match, you know, Holger kind of reinitiated that whole thing again. And, you know, what are your thoughts on him just kind of as a character or just like where you see his game, you know?
Well, Patrick Moritaga, I hope his coach Patrick would get out his case a little bit about that and tell him, listen, you lost, you beat him there and he made a comment and he's a veteran and you were not. Yeah. So you let it go. Don't be coming back to him now after he's now beaten you and making a wisecrack remark. That's not in your interest. It's not going to help you. It's only going to get in your way. That's my feeling. It's strange because he's got some commendable qualities. Terrific player, terrific competitor. In fact, he would be the next most likely top five candidate for me if it's not Sinner to break in there. It would be Holger Rune. But he needs to grow up. That was unnecessary, totally unnecessary. And he actually was a little bit lucky that this match was even close. Because Stan's at match point at 7-5-3. I mean, this should have been Stan's match easily and straight, and Stan then had to fight hard to win it in the third instead. I don't understand the idea of trash talking your opponent after you've lost to him, and that's something that needs to change. But
it was definitely on his mind for the last 5 months. You know, you can definitely tell it was on his mind, and he really thought about it, and then. Right as they were checking.
That's all the more reason to edit yourself and say, no, maybe it's better I let it go. And you vent to your coach, but you don't say it to your opponent who's beaten you, because he's getting a reputation, at least that's what I'm hearing.
That's what Stan said after the match as well, that reputation in the locker room that he would regret.
Yeah, well, but like who needs that? It's hard enough to beat these guys without, being a kind of a reviled figure in the game, the people, and they don't respect you. That's bad karma. You don't need that. So I hope for his sake that he'll, and he's got people around him that can guide him in this area and make him understand that that's not in his best interest. Because he's such a dynamic player. He's so good off the ground. I mean, I think he's going to get a lot better. And this, he can put losses like this one to stand behind him in a hurry and get on a good roll again. But I hope there won't be any more moments like the one he had with Stan after the match. I hope that's done.
Yeah, for sure. And then, of course, it was good to see Felix back in the quarters and played the amazing match against Tommy Paul. See those six match points, really had no business coming through. And, you know, five of those six were really all credit Felix, I would say. So that was...
Yeah, they were. And both times he was triple match point down. First a left 40 unserved to get to the breaker and then to be 6-3 down in the breaker. So that's what made it so astounding to me. It's hard enough to sort of climb out of isolated match points or maybe even a 40-15 or a 15-40, but left 40 and then 3-6 in the tie break. Very, very, very good effort. And I agree. Five of the six. He was lucky on one. One backhand miss hits. Shank somehow stayed in the court, cross court backhand, and then elicited an error from Tommy, understandably. But otherwise, he earned them all.
Yep.
And it was an important win for him, despite losing the first time to Carlos. So I feel like FAA is sort of on the way back. And we know he could play great tennis on clay, too. He did last year, and he had the five-setter with Rafa at Roland Garros. Very good match with Novak earlier in the clay court season. So I feel like I hope we're going to see him come back to the form that won three tournaments in a row last fall. Granted, that was a hot streak at the end of the year, but nonetheless, I want to see Felix back at his best again. This was much closer to his best.
Yeah, and I think Miami will be an important tournament for him. He's been to the semis here
well in
2019. So I think he can do well there, and he's tended to do well now at the Masters Series tournaments. And obviously, I'm also keeping an eye out for Stefanos Tsitsipas because he's clearly not fit, but he's just sort of getting ready for the clay season. That's where I sort of expect more results from him, Monte Carlo.
Well, he's still a little concerned about his shoulder. I heard him talking, I suppose, with him today, where he feels the shoulder's getting better. He might have been better off not playing in
Well. Yeah. I was surprised. I was surprised that he played because the press conference he gave, it was very strange. Like, why are you even playing? And then in the match against Thompson, he was going to the slice backhand over and over.
Yeah. Oh, no. He was not himself.
It was.
So I hope he is healthy. And especially because around the corner is the clay court season. We know some of the best results of his career in the last couple of seasons have been on the clay. And obviously, a couple of years ago, he's in the finals of the French and two sets up against Novak. So clay is one of the most productive. That clay court season is always productive for him, and he's been healthy, and I hope he's healthy this time around because he doesn't want to miss out on those months. He needs good, strong results off of the clay, and he won't get it if that shoulder isn't healed. So I hope if he senses there's any problem in Miami, he should just pull out.
Yep. Totally agree. All right. Well, Steve, this was a great recap. We've covered a lot of ground as we tend to do in the amount of time that we have. So yeah. Looking forward to Miami, and yeah, enjoy it.
Well, Vance, thanks for having me on. As always, I enjoyed it. It's a very, very stimulating discussion, and you're a great observer of the game, and we seem to agree at about 98% of the things we talk about, maybe higher.
Maybe someday we'll find something we don't agree on, and it'll be fun.
That'd be fun. But anyway, thanks again. It was enjoyable.
Yeah, enjoyed it. Yeah, thanks a lot, Steve. Appreciate the kind words.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.